The meeting will come to order. We have quorum now, and we move those minutes first, right? Representative De La Forest would move the minutes of the February 1st meeting, and did you have, is that correct now?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I would offer an amendment regarding the minutes. I don't know if it's been distributed to the committee as a whole, or if I should just read it out loud so everybody knows. Okay. Members, I turn your attention to page 2 of the minutes for February 1st, 2007. We have agreed, Chairman Mallory and myself and staff and Representative Kalin, we do have an error to the minutes. And so my amendment would be on page 2, the fourth paragraph, I would delete the words, "The motion prevailed and the amendment was adopted." And instead, I would move the following language: "The committee took no action on the motion." Furthermore, Mr. Chairman, I would have one more amendment to make everything consistent. If you move down to the next paragraph, we need to strike after House File 189, the comma, the words "as amended," and the next comma to make everything consistent. So subject to any objections or discussion from the committee, I would move that amendment to the minutes, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any disagreement or discussion? Okay, all in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. Carries. Let's see. Was that all rolled into one motion then?
That's right. Well, Mr. Chairman, I think technically what we've done is we have adopted the amendment, so now we need to adopt our minutes as amended, so I'll make that motion, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Then all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
Aye.
Was that a late aye or a no? The minutes are adopted. The minutes of the February 6th, Representative Simon moves those. Is there any discussion on that? All in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed? Carries like 4-0. out of 12 people. Okay, today we have a presentation on tort law, and from Will Flegel, I think I can, yeah, see him up there. And we, over the over this term, we will have quite a few bills that involve that, and I think it's important to understand that, just as we will have a presentation. We already had it scheduled, for instance, on data practices, and that's also an unusual topic to many members, and so we're going to have the expert for many years from the state, Don Gimberlin, is going to come back. He was scheduled before and ran over time. So with that, Mr. Flegel, I think just go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Will Flegel, and I served recently as the moderator of the so-called Law School for Legislators at William Mitchell College of Law. I also have served as a professor of law at the University of Minnesota Law School and St. Thomas School of Law. I am formerly the chair of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board and a vice chair of the Minnesota Supreme Court's No Fault Standing Committee, and also practice law. And I have been asked to provide a general introduction to tort law or consumer law to supplement the information that we went over at the Law School for Legislators, for those of you who may have been able to attend. And I believe that there's a short nine-page summary in your packet. It would be my intention, Mr. Chair, to generally follow that outline, but with the Chair's permission, if members had questions, I would readily invite questions so that we can make this as useful as possible.
I was just going to ask if it was okay to ask questions during.
I wish you would.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll proceed then. And I intend to follow generally the outline that's contained in the materials, if you have them. To begin with, as an overview, these materials do is to acquaint those members, and I recognize that there are a number of members who have a legal training. The nature of these materials is intended as a basic introduction for those who may not have had the opportunity to acquaint themselves with this area of the law that obviously bears on the work of this committee in general and its responsibilities to make policy decisions relative to injuries that give rise to legal rights to seek monetary compensation. I'm going to do is to, first of all, acquaint you with what a tort law is and then give several specific examples. What I've done here, since I'm not confident I understand exactly the areas that you may think bear on this, is to just address most of the major kinds of torts that at least an attorney would see in the course of their practice. Tort law is in Minnesota and in the American civil justice system is a branch of law that allows people who have sustained injury through the wrongful acts of others to ask a jury to award monetary compensation for that injury or wrong. In this way, tort law is distinguished in part from criminal law. The purpose of criminal law, obviously, is to serve the interest of society, to remove individuals who have caused injury, whether to property or to person, from the public so that they cannot injure others, and to punish them for the wrong that they do, typically by means of imprisonment or by assessing a criminal a penalty or fine. The civil side of that, if you will, to criminal law is tort law, which allows an individual who is the one who has sustained an injury or perceives that they have been injured either to their person or their property or to their reputation to have access to the court system and to seek that money be paid to them for the damage that they contend and can prove to a jury was taken from them improperly. In the last decade at least, if not longer, the criminal justice system has expanded its use of so-called reparations or restitution as a means to see that the individual victim who is harmed receives some type of reimbursement to their out-of-pocket losses from the criminal wrongdoer. That's in Chapter 611A of our statutes. But the primary purpose of criminal law is to serve the benefit of society as a whole rather than to address the actual injury or cost of the victim. And so the payment of reparations or of restitution when ordered by a court is obviously beneficial in its purpose and makes the individual wrongdoer accountable to a degree. But its primary purpose is not intended to compensate for all that was taken. That is essentially the function of the tort law system, to allow someone who was injured to seek that type of compensation. A tort law comes into being not by statute, not by the type of laws, obviously, that would be passed by the legislature, but rather it's a creature of what lawyers would refer to as the common law. And common law is basically a system that flows mainly from English law concepts in which once the citizens gained their power from the king, they were permitted to protect their property, protect their person, and their privacy. The courts themselves decreed or declared those rights. They're similar in some respects to the same fundamental principles that became embodied in writing in the Constitution. But tort law is mainly something that evolves from what law professors would call judge-made law. Obviously, it has a bearing on statutory law, the type of law that would be enacted by the legislature. You may need to correct what you might perceive as a policy matter to be an inequity in the law made by the courts. You may need to speak or feel the need to speak to an area that has not been addressed by the courts. Law that is made by courts evolves literally over centuries, whereas the legislature has the opportunity to address a problem much more quickly. So the two obviously are related, and one may build upon the other. So it's worthwhile, obviously, to have a grounding in basic concepts of what tort law is. With that very basic background in mind, then, I've addressed several different kinds of torts that might be organized into categories based on the type of rights that are involved. And the first that I've chosen to discuss in the written materials at the bottom of page 2 of the outline is personal, whether the right to the integrity of your person, your health, your safety, and so forth. And at its most fundamental, this type of personal injury law would involve basic torts of assault and battery as well as negligence. The divide here is between torts that are intended and torts for which an injury occurs and the actor did not specifically intend to bring about harm. The legal system addresses both of those kinds of injuries or torts. Among the intentional tort category would include the tort of assault, where I take a swing at Mr. Verdon and I miss, and he is frightened by that. That would be assault. If I connect, that is battery. And so that's the distinction in the common law. In terms of its use in typical day-to-day practice, intentional tort law does not actively play a major part of the litigation that forms the civil justice system. If we take a look at the types of cases that do get prosecuted through our civil courts, in comparison to criminal courts, the majority of the cases that would go to the courts for resolution would involve typically claims of negligence, and then there are several permutations of that in Minnesota: strict liability, malpractice torts, statutory tort claims, and then I'm also going to address some potential new tort areas or areas that the courts are talking about on a regular basis, potentially extending. But the fundamental thing that occupies our court system are torts based on negligence concepts. And just to introduce you to what negligence is in the law, that's basically a rule that says, as citizens interacting with one another, we have a fundamental obligation to act reasonably towards one another. That means we have the obligation or duty to do what a reasonable person would do and to refrain from doing what would be unreasonable. In the event a person is injured, the classic example might be a motor vehicle accident in which a collision occurs and someone contends they sustain either property or personal injury as a consequence. In addition to demonstrating that the operator who's accused of wrong did something negligent, what a reasonable person would not do, whether that be speeding, going through a traffic control device, passing inappropriately, or whatever, they must demonstrate that a duty, a legal duty, was owed if they are seeking compensation, and show how that duty was then breached, and then establish to the satisfaction of the jury and of the court that they sustained genuine and real damage as a consequence to that. Duty as a concept is probably one of the most fundamental that underlie the nub of the issues that the courts confront in negligence claims. In general, courts have been slow to create duties being owed between one person and another member of society beyond those duties that have been recognized for many, many years. And in the written materials, sort of in the middle of page 3, I've outlined some of these. For example, courts have said that there is no obligation for one individual to rescue or help another who is in the imminent risk of being injured. For example, there's a case called Errico versus Southland Corporation, in which our court ruled that if a storekeeper sees one of its patrons being assaulted, the storekeeper is permitted, they have no obligation to intervene in that fight or to rescue. The exception exists, or that has emerged in our law within the last roughly 20 years, fundamentally, is where a special relationship can be shown to exist either between the person who was injured and the person from whom a duty is said to be owed or between the wrongdoer and the person in a position to control the wrongdoer's conduct. But special relationships have been held to arise only in very narrow circumstances so as not to create, again, broad duties from one person to another.
Representative DeLaForest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Professor Fugel, I do have a question. You're talking about this difference between sort of government imposing the duty to do no harm to others as opposed to imposing a duty to do good to others. What is the political philosophy or underpinning? Where did we get this idea philosophically here in America that, for example, our laws are to prevent harm instead of imposing the duty to do good, so to speak?
Mr. Flegel?
Thank you, Representative DeLaForest. I guess I can only speak generally in that fashion. I think that some of these basic concepts emerged as constitutional provisions. The Founding Fathers, I think, were driven by some basic philosophical concepts that emerged from Great Britain. Locke, certainly, Judeo-Christian background. And then in balancing an obligation for aid against anything in which the government would seek to impose its view of right or wrong on individual citizens who may have a different philosophy. So at the time of its creation or coming into being in our country, if you imagine the two ends of the scale, an interest on the part of assuring our right to be safe in our person and in our property and so forth, and to act in such a manner as to help our neighbor without at the opposite end of the spectrum being made to do things, having just separated ourselves as a country from a legal framework in which the king could impose arbitrary obligations, including to allow soldiers to stay at your home without compensation. So as a broad philosophical question, I think it's always been a matter of balance. That being said, our civil justice system does include some admonitions to establish minimum codes of conduct, and obviously you can see that in the criminal law, but in the civil law context, that would include the legislature's passage of the Good Samaritan Act, which requires a person coming upon the scene of an emergency to exercise reasonable conduct to facilitate aid or help to the extent that they are able based upon their training and experience, and sort of exacting as a minimum obligation that they at least summon or call for help in order to provide aid to a person. And the quid pro quo for that is to essentially immunize them where in the exercise of their good faith they might inadvertently cause injury at the scene of an emergency. So to just kind of summarize, from a broad philosophical perspective, I think it's inherent in our system of justice and rules to balance individual liberties with what the government can command, and that may drive part of the bargain, but how over the course of our time here in Minnesota specifically, the legislature has spoken to establish some minimum guidelines, including the criminal law and the Good Samaritan Act in the civil context. I hope I've answered your question.
Mr. Chairman, Professor Flegel, thank you. I find it's very interesting. We're sort of having a philosophical discussion here today, and I do appreciate it, Mr. Chairman. It's always worthwhile, but I find it sort of ironic in a sense we debate issues like here we do not impose a duty upon another to help someone being physically assaulted, but sort of perhaps on the other end of the spectrum, government, some would force people to do good to themselves by preventing them from eating trans fatty acids and other things. And so it's interesting to juxtapose those two, for example. But I appreciate your input and your thoughts, Professor. Thank you.
Certainly. And I guess, Mr. Chair, what the legislature is always uniquely in the position to do is to set policy based on these different schools of thought and hopefully an appropriate balance between individual rights and the responsibility of government to protect its citizens is something that is achieved. Just to go back to the outline, in terms of other examples of where special relationships have been found to exist that do establish a rule to intervene and to help, they are uniquely in fact patterns where the a person who's accused was in the position of providing control or providing assistance and declined to do so. One of the examples I've given is the obligation of a hotel keeper for its guests. If I'm a guest at a hotel, I don't have the choice of locks. I'm counting on the hotel for having adequate security and may not therefore be in a position of assuring my own safety. So that was actually one of the first areas recognized for obligation, is that a hotel keeper has an obligation to its guests as a special relationship. Another case that emerged after Connolly against Nicollet Hotel is Sylvester versus Northwest Hospital, in which a hospital was held to have that obligation to individuals who are patients. Obviously, if I'm still suffering the effects of an operation or under medication, I may not be able to look out for my own safety, so the hospital has a special relationship to deal with that. More recently, as the legislature has entered into the regulation of professional liquor vendors, bars have been held to a duty to their customers to see to their well-being, and Prue versus Bart's about 50 years ago. Usually, if a duty exists, it's something that the law says cannot be avoided by my ignoring it. For example, I may have a duty to reasonably address the snow that's accumulated on my front porch or sidewalk. I can't simply close the drapes and ignore that condition. But that being said, in order to carry forward an effective case, one that will prevail in the courts, the individual who claims injury must demonstrate under the common law that the person who they're asking to act had actual notice, or at least constructive notice, that there was a problem before the individual be made to intervene. An example of that might be the spilled milk at the food store in aisle 3. If I, as the owner of the store, am unaware through the exercise of reasonable diligence that a spill has occurred, I have no legal duty to intervene and to clean it up until I become made reasonably aware of that danger. Now, that again, balanced against the other issue that I can't ignore situations, probably requires some reasonable exercise of vigilance on my part to patrol the store and assure that problems are not occurring. But fundamentally, before a duty can be imposed, before compensation can be awarded, an awareness when you're proceeding with a matter under negligence law must be demonstrated that the person who's accused of wrong had a reasonable notice, so that they would have had a reasonable opportunity to act. Just to complete that thought with respect to the care of sidewalks and so forth, as a part of the common law, if a storm is still occurring and precipitation is still falling, our courts have said that there's no duty to act until a reasonable period after the storm has abated. All of these concepts basically seek to balance reasonableness. What would a reasonable person do under the circumstances? The final element generally that has to exist before one can take forward a claim of negligence through the civil courts and successfully obtain compensation or damages is to demonstrate that the injury be foreseeable. And that's another sort of ticklish area in the law. Foreseeability does not mean that the exact precise harm that occurs had to be foreseen before the act was done. As long as it's generally foreseeable that something bad could have ensued from my, for example, one of the cases includes firing a gun into the porch of a house. I may not have intended to strike someone, but it was reasonably foreseeable that my act could have led to injury. So if harm is foreseeable in general, the court will impose that duty. The final element in this and in all claims is the necessity of demonstrating that harm has occurred, that either medical bills have been incurred, that lost wages have been sustained, or that some physical harm has come to the individual in this type of personal injury litigation. And non-speculative proof of those losses must be given before the court will allow witnesses to testify in our civil justice system. And then the court serves as kind of a second guesser, if you will, of the jury's award of damages. The judge is permitted to remit or reduce damages in the event that the court feels that they've been awarded out of passion or prejudice, or to grant the right to a new trial. We also have the appellate courts that sit in supervision of our district court judges and can act as a further review against those questions.
Just a second, Chair. Representative Simon.
Representative Simon.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before we leave this topic and go off of sort of the duty concept, could you tell the committee where you think the law is or is going with respect to vicarious liability? You gave the grocery store example. Let's say one of the bag boys is sexually harassing another employee. At what point in Minnesota at this time, or what's the trajectory of when and under what circumstances the grocery store would be on the hook for the bad act of the bag boy?
Mr. Flegel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, thank you for asking that question. That is an area that I did not specifically address in the paper, but it is an interesting and sort of developing area. If I can kind of give you some background first and then address that. First of all, the concept of vicarious liability is distinguished from the two types of examples I've given thus far. We've talked about my intentional act or my careless act. That's where I've done something wrong. But if I'm now the employer and I merely hired someone and they have acted inappropriately, either intentionally or negligently, and caused injury, that responsibility that might be owed by me as the employer of that bad actor, that is a concept referred to as vicarious liability. And that has been imposed initially through the English legal system and based on property law concepts where a landlord would have obligations. But it now has been firmly ingrained in our civil justice system in the context of an employer's responsibility for employees. At present, the general rules in this regard are that as to either intentional acts of misconduct by an employee or as to negligent acts of misconduct by an employee, the employer stands responsible as long as three conditions exist. The incident that causes harm must have occurred at a workplace, at a work time, and generally be in the course and scope of the employee's work obligations. A couple of classic examples. One is the, can't recall the name of the plaintiff at the moment, but we call it the Nabisco case or the cookie salesman case. Cookie salesman goes to a grocery store and gets in an argument with the grocer about the display of just where their cookies should go, because at a higher place of visibility they're going to sell more merchandise. And the cookie salesman intentionally assaults the owner of the store, not the owner, but a clerk. And that injured person then made a claim against the cookie salesman and against their employer. The salesman really had no resources, so if the person was going to be compensated, it would be against their employer. The Supreme Court ruled in that case, Lange was the name of the plaintiff, L-A-N-G-E, that the as a public policy matter, in order to afford the injured person a source of compensation, they would make the principal responsible for even the intentionally wrongful acts of the agent, on the basis that as a public policy matter, the employer could secure a source of general liability insurance coverage to insure against the incident, would be prompted in light of that obligation to make inquiry into the background and qualifications, demeanor, and nature of their individual employees so as to promote a greater likelihood that qualified, reasonable people would be hired, and in that manner protect the public by policing the individual actions of their individual. Did you have a follow-up question?
Representative Simon.
Thank you. What about the kind of tort that I described, though, that's more in the employment context? You described a common law battery, basically.
Right.
But what about sex harassment? What about my hypothetical where the bag boy at the grocery store is sexually harassing either a customer or another employee? What is the burden right now in order to prove vicarious liability?
Representative Simon, I just have a question of clarification. In my district down on 26th Avenue at the little market store, the bag boy is the guy that runs up to the tree or something and brings back the little baggies with the drugs in them.
That's not what the one he's talking about. That's quite what I meant. Quite well
said. I think Mr. Flegel probably understands.
Assuming that the bag boy is not under the influence of any chemicals, recreational or otherwise, but rather is in the course and scope of their duties, the inquiry or current focus of the court would be whether this occurs at a in a workplace where the employer has the obligation by primarily federal law under Title VII and other enactments to promote a safe and healthful work environment. For example, there would be an obligation to assure not only that you post how to contact OSHA in the event of a work-related injury, but to see that in the locker room, offensive literature and other things are not posted, which would tend to demean or insult someone. In the event that one employee feels that they're being harassed by another employee in violation of those rules, the injured person, before there would be an obligation on the part of the employer, generally, the injured person or person claiming injury must contact the supervisor or their employer, report the conduct that they contend is offensive or non-conforming, and afford the employer the opportunity to cure that through reasonable measures. The courts, as you might expect with this broad rule, have responded in varying ways depending upon unique facts. There are examples I could give you in which a high-level obligation was exacted, and there are facts that gave rise to where only minimal responsive obligations were required based on the broad parameters of the law. But fundamentally, where the employer knows, either directly or through the reporting of the incident to a supervisor, they are then charged with the duty to act. And if you reflect back on my earlier remarks about a duty arising only when someone had notice or an opportunity to know, it's that basic core concept that then governs the responsibility of the employer to act. Once they have that obligation, whether their response will be viewed as reasonable or unreasonable under the circumstances is highly variable to the work environment, the past interaction of the parties, and so forth. Pretty much where the court does draw a line, if there is a line, is thus far at least the obligation of the employer ends in the workplace, as opposed to two people taking their personal relationship, say a boyfriend and girlfriend, whether or not they're living together, happen to work in the same location. If they're interacting in a manner that may not implicate the employer's obligations, if this is really just a further evolution of their personal relationship, that would be a defense available to the employer.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the last one. I want to be respectful of everyone's time. I'm not bringing these up to hear myself talk. It's that I think we will, I'm told that we will likely be addressing this issue this session in certain contexts. So I guess the follow-up question is, I want to make sure I have it clear that if an employer in the situation that I presented, say the grocery store, has no idea that this was going on at all or no reason to know, let's say the bag boy was very discreet, the kind of bag boy I'm talking about, Mr. Chair. The bag boy was very discreet, but during break time, only one-on-one with no other witnesses and no one reporting, the employer simply didn't know this was going on, had no idea, and that the victim or alleged victim never reported it. Would there be any liability under that very strict fact situation? Would there be any liability for the corporation or for the grocery store?
Mr. Flegel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, under what I understand to be an extreme example, I believe that there would not be. I would temper that with two observations. One would be that if you'll hearken back to my earlier remark about not being able to ignore a situation, one person's discreet is another person's not so discreet. So if there were reasonable indicia of a problem that a person exercising reasonable powers of observation should have, then the answer would be there may be liability there. In the event it's something that if we simply assume as fact that the employer did not know and was not in a position to know, then the opposite result would apply. There is a difference, however, if I can depart from your the analogy we've been talking about is specifically in a commercial context. That's the other thing I wanted to point out very briefly, is that in other contexts, a duty would be held to exist, potentially even in the absence of notice. And that would be, for example, I can think of a school situation where children are a vulnerable age, obviously, and the teacher may be accused of having acted inappropriately. There would be, separate and apart from this doctrine where we've talked about vicarious liability, where literally the employer has done nothing wrong. It's an employee who's done the wrongful act. There could exist what we would call a direct action for negligence against the employer for the negligent hiring of people who may have had a predisposition to cause these kinds of difficulties. Recognize that's different than the question that you asked, but these two areas would operate in tandem in the typical civil law setting. If I may then, Mr. Chair, just to kind of resume this, we're at page 4 of the outline, and if I'm talking too long or not long enough, Mr. Chair, I hope you'll let me know. I'm going to address next the concept of strict liability torts, and these are fundamentally what we would call as an evolution of that body of law, generally referred to as product liability. We've talked about intentional acts of wrong where someone is striking another, or negligent acts, the kind of things that might occur in my operation of my motor vehicle or the manner in which that I police the well-being or safety of my home or my business place. What product liability fundamentally addresses is if I've purchased a product and that product malfunctions in some manner and causes me injury, I may have rights under the civil law to bring a product liability claim against the manufacturer of that product. And so this subject area addresses in a very fundamental way what the same elements or essential ingredients are for someone claiming injury to advance a successful claim for strict liability. Now, someone who has, say, purchased a product that turns out to be defective in some manner and it causes injury could also proceed against the manufacturer with a claim of negligence. Could say the manufacturer negligently made this product in a dangerous fashion. They may find it more difficult to prevail with certain kinds of products, particularly those that may be perceived as more dangerous than others, for example, pharmaceuticals, other complex machinery, because it may well be that a manufacturer did not have notice, had no indication that their product was in any way dangerous or defective until that first injury occurs. And so rather than allow the manufacturer one injury without compensation, what the courts did was to say, we're going to bring into being through the common law in the early 1920s a concept called strict liability, where we will essentially hold each manufacturer to the obligation that they are to be an expert within the unique field in which they're operating. So the manufacturer of industrial equipment would be held to the duty to keep themselves apprised of developments of how to effectively safeguard their products so as to minimize the risk or potential for injury or harm. And then liability would be imposed upon the injured person demonstrating that the product was, as designed, unreasonably dangerous for ordinary uses. The use has to be either has to always be a foreseeable use of the product in order to require the duty to act. It can be a foreseeable use or a foreseeable misuse, but it must be foreseeable. As a social policy, then, the courts created this additional type of claim for strict liability. Traditionally, it would address issues where a manufacturer may have to be forward-thinking in their development of a product so as to accompany it with appropriate instructions in the safe use, particularly, for example, in the taking of medications. How should this drug be taken, for whom is it intended, what are the side effects of that, and so forth, or if not, an obligation to properly warn or instruct, then an obligation to design the product in such a way as to guard against or reduce the risk of harm. That would be difficult with medications, but you could imagine a circumstance in which a product could be equipped with a guard so as to prevent inadvertent access to a danger area, or equipped with a safety device like a guard on a lawnmower or seat belts in cars and so forth. The fundamental area here of strict liability for product defects in Minnesota underwent kind of a unique modification in the early 1980s, in which our Supreme Court actually borrowed strongly from negligence law concepts. And so our strict liability law works at present quite similarly to how negligence law works. The other essential ingredient, besides proving that a real and genuine injury has occurred, is that the person who claims injury must also show that reasonable alternatives existed to the product manufacturer. And when I said just a few moments ago that our Supreme Court uses negligence concepts, what I mean by that specifically is that our Supreme Court said, as we address reasonable alternatives and the need to show those, essentially we will not require the manufacturer of products to spend endless amounts of money against very slight or remote risks of harm. We will, however, require the manufacturer to weigh and balance risk against benefit. And in a performance of a risk-benefit analysis, if it appears as though the cost or compromise that occurs from having a safety modification of the type that the injured person claims is necessary would defeat the entire purpose or so slow or so act as a detriment to the regular operation of the product, will not require a manufacturer to do that. So reasonable alternatives is the final ingredient. And for example, in the written materials, I talk about how it's been held in Clio against Ford Motor Company that those reasonable alternatives have to generally be demonstrated. For example, if a metal part has failed and that part is through poured metal where foreseeably air bubbles can create, and that can create an inadvertent unintended joint that could result in the fracture of that product, or the product could be created through hard rolled steel or some other non-poured, non-porous metal, the courts have said that if that can be done on an economic basis, then the manufacturer may be held to account for that. Our strict liability area of the law underwent its most extensive expansion in the 1970s, and really since the 80s has not undergone significant change within our state. The next area, unless there are any questions that I address in the written materials, is malpractice torts. Malpractice is basically a negligence claim against a professional of any kind, whether it be a medical professional, a legal professional, architect, engineer, and so forth. The professional is judged, as Representative De La Forest was pointing out, essentially we're judged against the lowest standard, the lowest common denominator sets our responsibilities to one another in our social interaction. And that is the rule relative to malpractice. So in that type of claim specifically, before an injured person or a person claiming injury can proceed with the case, they must demonstrate that and establish what the minimum standard was within the industry involved. If it's medicine, for example, what should an average doctor in the specialty that was implicated by the person's symptoms do in light of the following history and the following examination results, the following diagnostic test indications? Are there three reasonable alternatives for treatment? Did the doctor perform a fourth that is not on the list recognized by other doctors in good standing? what the state legislature did in this regard in the late 1980s and early 1990s is to create a further level of protection to professionals generally to assure that so-called frivolous lawsuits were not brought that did not have a basis in fact. And to assure that that was done, the legislature required for medical malpractice lawsuits under Minnesota Statute 145.682 and for claims involving allegations of wrongdoing against architects, engineers, lawyers, or other professionals under 544.42 that a person claiming injury must come forward with a sworn affidavit from a professional in the same field of specialty as the one accused and seek from that person to say that they've reviewed the evidence available and conclude that the accused professional did indeed depart from even the minimum standard of care and that that departure was the cause of injury before they can proceed with the prosecution of a claim for damages. And there have been some recent modifications to this area within the last roughly 5 years where a safe harbor has been created so that in the event someone fails to do that in a timely fashion, that they have an opportunity to come forward with their evidence. Otherwise, our courts have ruled that even if a case does have or would have merit in the abstract, that case may be dismissed in the event that these technical requirements under 145.682 and 544.42 were not followed. The case can be dismissed. The general rule then is the same as would be the case in negligence law. You must demonstrate genuine injuries causally tied to the act of wrong. The next area that's addressed in the materials. Oh, sorry,
Mr. Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Professor Flegel, with regard to the expert affidavit requirement that exists for professional liability claims, you indicated that the affidavit needs to be submitted before the claim can be prosecuted. Isn't it the case, I haven't practiced law for a couple of years and certainly haven't done anything in this area for a couple of years, but isn't it the case that the claim can actually be started, at least in the medical malpractice context, but that there's a timing requirement for submission of the affidavit? So whether it's a situation where a plaintiff is at the tail end of the statute of limitations and needs to start a claim in order to protect his or her claim, they can do that without the affidavit, but the affidavit has to come within a certain period of time. Am I remembering that correctly?
Mr. Flegel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, that is correct. With regard to the medical malpractice, under 145.682 sub 3, there is an alternative that allows a person confronting the statute of limitations, which is now 4 years for medical malpractice, to file their lawsuit. They then have a period of 180 days to respond, but essentially the lawyer, if it's a lawyer involved filing the case, has to file an affidavit saying, I didn't have enough time to do my due diligence in advance, and I promise or commit to do that. And in the event that they fail within that secondary time frame, then the safe harbor is violated, and their case would be dismissed. But specifically as regards the time limit for a case in which the statute of limitations is threatened, you can begin the case. In other circumstances, the affidavit responsibility under subdivision, there's a responsibility under subdivision 2 and subdivision 4 for actually two affidavits. In order to commence the litigation, an attorney must submit an affidavit saying that they have consulted with an expert within the field and that they've been advised by the expert in good faith that there's a valid claim. Thereafter, within 180 days, there's an obligation to come forward with a second, more detailed affidavit. Typically, in practice, that may be a 20 to 40 page affidavit in which the expert discloses precisely the records that they've reviewed, what specific items within those records suggest them, what the facts are as to what occurred, how those facts deviated from the obligation that they believe existed spelling out in detail what that obligation is and how those deviations physically produced the injury. As to this area, maybe beyond what you're asking, but the area that has come to emerge, particularly within the medical malpractice field, that's of interest to practitioners, at least in recent years, is the development of a further device called a Mac-Fry hearing, or Fry-Mac, depending upon whether you're a fan of McDonald's, I guess. But Fry actually refers to a district court case in federal court from the 1950s that says that before any expert witness may testify, they have to be testifying in a field that's recognized as generally accepted, so that I can't, for example, use a lie detector to as an ingredient that's not a reliable tool under the view of our court. At one point in time, DNA evidence was not sufficiently viewed as accepted and sophisticated to be used. That now largely is, depending upon the type of evidence. So what this Fry-Mac type hearing is in Minnesota exists as a further challenge to simply an allegation by an expert that a violation has occurred. Their credentials, their foundation, and the acceptability of the tests upon which they rely for their opinion can be challenged and excluded by a judge in a hearing before the case would ever be permitted to then go to a fact finder to weigh the relative, I think it is a case, I don't think it's a case, testimony of the respective experts.
Mr. Flegel, just for the members of the committee, he's been talking about the Fry case. If you remember when we had the BCA over, they were talking about the Fry case, about all the problems that they're running into now with some of the tests that were formerly accepted, just to connect to two different areas. Representative Coles, did you want to know?
Very briefly, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Flegel, is there a similar ability in other professional negligence cases to bring the claim before you have the affidavit as exists in the medical malpractice context?
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, 544.42 was written actually after and based on 145.682. So yes, essentially there is.
Mr. Chair, members, I think this is an interesting discussion, and I think the expert affidavit requirement in these types of cases, from my perspective at least, is an important tool when we're talking about professional liability. You know, it's hard to unring that bell. It's kind of like, when did you stop beating your wife? If somebody gets served with a lawsuit, that can have significant professional ramifications in the ability for a lawyer or a doctor or an architect to continue to do business. It may have insurance implications, liability insurance implications into the future. And so I'm pleased that we have those types of requirements. And I guess I'd be curious, Mr. Flegel, have other states looked to what Minnesota's done? Has anybody else done anything similar, or are they doing things differently? I know in your paper here you talk about caps, and we've had a little bit of debate around here over the last few years about caps. It's never happened. I know other states have done that. Has anybody else looked at the expert affidavit requirement outside of the Fry-Mac type of hearing?
Something on the front end. Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, four other states have use the Minnesota model. The federal government was considering doing that about 4 years ago, and instead went to the cap approach, and then ultimately rejected that, or I shouldn't say rejected it, was unable to achieve passage of that. The Minnesota's approach to assuring an advance indication that there's been a violation there, or at least enough to create a prima facie, a basic case, is so far still somewhat unique. Our neighboring states are beginning to look at or to embrace that, North Dakota and Wisconsin. It is interesting, since the development of that safeguard, there are, at least that I know from published decisions of our appellate courts, roughly 80 cases that have refused to allow the claimant to take the matter forward based on nonconformities perceived within the affidavits. So,
Mr. Fliegel, I have a question.
Yes.
Doesn't that also affect the, is that part of the reason why we have one of the lowest malpractice insurance premium rates in the country? Or does it have anything to do with
Mr.
that?
Mr. Chair, that takes me a little outside my area of expertise,
okay.
But Minnesota doesn't enjoy a relatively low rate compared to other states. At one point, when I last looked, they were in like the lower 10. I think it will vary, however, from specialty to specialty.
I was thinking in medical malpractice.
And I'm thinking I'm thinking even within specialty medical fields. Oh. Obstetrics might be different than general medicine and so forth. So if you're making an assessment of where we rated, you know, one area of specialty might complain more loudly than another in terms of its rates and costs and so forth.
Representative Cornish had a question.
We'll allow for a little levity.
Uh-oh.
And a true story. Some years ago, I was cooking for the kids, and I opened this can of corn, and a great big worm fell out with a black head, and it looked like a European corn borer, as far as I know, in a can of corn. I debated whether to eat it and make the kids sick, or fry it, or throw it away. And so what I did was I kept it in a little jar like formaldehyde or something and put it up on the shelf, and then I wrote this company a letter. And what they did was they sent me a whole box full of coupons for more free product. And I was wondering if limitations have run out now since 1988 happened. And if I was severely traumatized enough to make a claim, you know.
I think unless it's murder or something like that.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'd slip you my card, but I think that the time has expired on your claim. Seriously, one of the organizations that I recently was president of is the Minnesota Trial Lawyers Association. We have a computer way of communicating with one another called a listserv, which operates kind of like a blog. And many of the members, particularly younger ones, will recount a client just came in my office and opened a jar of fill-in-the-blank and something rather undesirable was, you know, yielded by that discovery. You know, what should I do about it? And kind of the running joke is, well, you know, if you want to handle that on a percentage fee basis, you're entitled to, you know, 25% to one-third of the candy bars or whatever else it is that your client is going to get offered by the manufacturer seeking to make good in that regard. There, if you're genuinely interested, there is a whole subspecialty about foreign articles in food products. We do have a number of state statutes that govern this. The federal law has actively legislated standards about this. Obviously, salmonella and other kinds of concerns present themselves, and you may have some call to operate in that area. Generally, if the item is truly a foreign item, one set of rules apply, which operate very similar to strict liability, where you would have a pretty straightforward case. Where it is not exactly a foreign object, like a pit in a cherry, a stricter standard of review applies so that you have a harder case to take forward. So when you're having your cherry pie, be careful before you bite down.
I think I'll just save and use it for bait or something.
Mr. Fliegel.
Okay, thank you. What I'll move on then to is to statutory tort claims. We've talked about how the common law created in large measure these basic concepts of responsibilities that we have one to one another. However, where our legislature has spoken to an area, our courts have also allowed people to base claims based on that, even in some circumstances where the state statute did not specifically say it was intended for the purpose of allowing someone to be sued. Examples of where the legislature has said that it contemplates that its statute would be used to afford someone a civil remedy include our dog bite statute under 347.22. Used to be under the common law that you could only obtain compensation from the owner of an animal after demonstrating that the owner had reasonable advance knowledge that its dog was dangerous, that it had a propensity to do this, that typically would create, again, a situation where the first person who's injured would not be able to take forward a claim. And so the legislature created a rule that said, no, we will impose strict liability in the event that an injury occurs unless the owner can demonstrate as an affirmative defense that its animal was provoked, or that the person who was injured while trespassing, not being in a place where they were legally entitled to be, that liability would then ensue for whatever damages flow from that. About 20 years ago, there was a distinction between outstate Minnesota and metropolitan areas where this rule that I've described applied in the metropolitan areas but not in greater Minnesota, and that was changed by the legislature to say that that rule entitles citizens, regardless of where they live, to the same protection. The other area that the legislature has spoken extensively is the so-called dram shop claim or civil damages act under 340A.801. The legislature creates the obligation on the part of professional liquor vendors to assure that alcohol is sold legally, and then establishes a series of specific circumstances in which sales are legal and not legal. For example, it is illegal to sell to minors. It is illegal to sell to someone who is already obviously intoxicated. After hour sales to non-club members and so forth are part of the regulations under 340A for violations that are set out in .504. Wrongful death claims are other statutory claims. There was no common law right in the event that someone was killed as the consequence of another's wrongful act to make a claim. At the common law, if you were injured, the injured person could take a claim forward, but if the person died, their claim died with them. The legislature then created a right on the part of surviving family members to have a trustee appointed, and to have that trustee then advance a claim and seek to prove that their loved one was caused to die through the wrongful act of another, whether that act was intentional or negligent, involved malpractice, product liability, or whatever. For many years, caps were set on those damages at $25,000, and that was removed. All caps were removed by the legislature in the 1970s. And that's currently codified in 57301. Pro se negligence is kind of a general catch-all category into which all other kinds of statutory-based tort claims would fall, where the legislature has spoken to try to regulate a given profession or a given industry and has set guidelines thereafter in the event that a person is injured and they are seeking to prove what a reasonable person would do under the like or similar circumstances. If a given profession or a given industry is implicated, the injured person might make resort to the regulatory guidelines passed by the legislature or passed administratively. Our courts have said that that type of claim called negligence per se allows the a governmental enactment to establish the minimum standard of care and then judge the accused person's conduct against that. And I've placed several examples in the materials there. So that, for example, in Melcher versus McMahon, the sale of toxic glue to a minor, which was prohibited, was allowed to be used as the basis for an injury claim by others who were harmed from that purchase. A law requiring pipelines to be well maintained against leaks in Mahold versus Minnesota Gas Company was allowed to set the standard for judging whether the company had acted appropriately in maintenance of its facilities. And then reporting requirements relative to physical abuse, our Child Abuse Reporting Act, or the Vulnerable Adults Abuse Reporting Act, Radke versus the County of Freeborn, established that could serve as a basis for a private claim as well as to establish a governmental limit for conduct. I've talked very briefly about potential new torts, only to observe that our Our courts generally have, in Minnesota, have been very slow to expand torts beyond what common law came over from England, with the exception, at least in this personal injury context, of product liability, which really began to emerge as the Industrial Revolution took root. Then I was going to turn on to the topic of property torts. I've summarized in the materials. I'm sorry. Was there a
call? Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Hellstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to go back to the per se D for a moment. There was a case in another state where child had been turned in for child protective services, and then child protection failed in that, and then the child died. And then a lawsuit was brought, but they found that child protection, while had a responsibility to protect the child, didn't have a responsibility to guarantee protection. Would that fall under this, and is Minnesota the same?
Mr. Flegel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, we're the same but different. there are two separate areas of the law.
There are
two separate areas of the law that are implicated here in Minnesota, and that may vary depending upon the state that you're referring to, may or may not have the same concepts. If it's a state agency, our statute 3.763 is implicated. If it's a county agency, then 466.03 is implicated. Those are immunity statutes. They say that the government may not be sued for injuries that occur from the failure by the government to perform its duties and obligations. So that, for example, there is a case involving a daycare where the county had allegedly approved someone for licensure that it shouldn't, and an injury resulted. They sued the accused daycare provider, but given the limited resources available, then they also made a claim against the government. And those immunity statutes, which came into being in the early 70s and have somewhat expanded since that time, say that the government, in light of scarce resources, should not be made accountable for individual claims, even if a wrong has occurred. Even if the discretion that exists to the government is abused, the statute says, you still can't sue the government. And that's just a policy decision to balance what to do with scarce resources. Is the rights of a single individual as or more important than the responsibility that the legislature has to take limited dollars and see that the government is paying for programs it needs to? So that immunity area could potentially change the outcome of the civil claim for violation of, for example, the Child Abuse Reporting Act, where more typically the Child Abuse Reporting Act, or CARA, has given rise to private causes of action under negligence per se, is against, for example, teachers who failed to report, or medical professionals who failed to report. There is currently a case pending that was argued in late December to the Minnesota Supreme Court, the name of which escapes me for the moment, that had been tried in the Rochester area, where there was an accusation that the medical facility knew that a child who had sustained spiral fractures must have been harmed in the home, and that the physicians therefore had an obligation under this act to have asked the police to intervene. There's a mandatory, it's actually a misdemeanor not to act when you have knowledge. And so what our Supreme Court is now going to be called upon to do is to balance some of these potentially conflicting concepts and articulate a rule. But we have the same, many states have the same sort of per se approach because it's part of our common law. If you can establish that there's a statute and that statute sets a standard of conduct, everyone should be made to conform their conduct to it. That would be the general rule. But as to certain actors, some of them have more protection than others, and specifically if the example is a county, local, or state government, they may be covered by immunity so that even if they had acted in violation, they may be not able to be sued.
One follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hellstrom, but could we, I want to make sure that he covers especially the privacy and the alternatives, so if
okay,
you could.
I can.
Could those two, I think, are important because
sure.
we're going to also the nuisance. I know there's a bill coming up already
and
on that. So if you could kind of do those maybe quickly, and then we can get to Representative Hillstrom and Representative Coles.
I apologize if I got too chatty here on some of these. But in the middle of page 7, specifically, the tort of nuisance is addressed. In the top of page 7, I'm talking about general property tort rights. Most of our discussion thus far has focused on if a person is injured. This is if property is threatened or injured. In Minnesota, there is both a public and private nuisance law. As to public nuisance, very typically, there are state statutes that address some of these issues. Very, very basically, everyone is entitled to the so-called quiet enjoyment of their property, and in the event that that is threatened, either by noise, by certain uses of property, by odors, and so forth, the individual whose property rights are threatened or harmed by that may apply to the civil courts to have that harm set aside, either through what we would call injunctive relief, asking a court to declare that that use may not continue, or through the seeking of private compensation. Again, as a very basic rule, this is a balancing of the same sort of reasonableness concepts that I addressed earlier. What is a in order to prevail, you have to demonstrate an unreasonable interference with your rights. So in my example, a loud stereo may be something I have to listen to until 10 o'clock, for example. The courts may set a balance. Now, these remarks address civil claims. There are also criminal nuisance statutes that exist. They relate, and the same is true with trespass. For example, you can trespass by putting your foot on someone's property. You can trespass by taking things off of the property of another. In the news recently, all of the theft of copper pipe and so forth could create remedies under the trespass law. Very basically, the next and I'll leave the last areas addressed are privacy torts. In addition to our right to be secure in our person and secure in our property, another concept from England is that we have the right to our personal integrity, and what people say about me behind my back can obviously cause injury to me. What our common law does is to allow a person to go to court and to prove that someone has stated an untruth and that that untruth has caused injury to reputation in the community. And again, as a balance, the law always seeks a balance. As a balance, public figures, people who are in the media, whether it's a politician or a movie star, they have a higher burden created to them before they can make a claim. They must, before they can sue a newspaper or someone else, demonstrate that the person who spoke negatively about them had actual malice, which means essentially that they knew what they were saying was false as opposed to simply speaking recklessly. Our court most recently spoke to this issue in a case about 5 years ago called Lake versus Walmart, in which someone had their vacation pictures, which some of which were rather candid, at a nude beach, that were developed by the photography store, and an employee of the store took interest in the photographs and posted them and published them. That was held to create a violation of the person's privacy right. Until the interest in the photographs and posted them and published them, that was held to create a violation of the person's privacy right. Until the Supreme Court expressed that, though, Minnesota had no articulated common law right of privacy. And the court, in announcing its decision in Lake versus Walmart, said, we've had this opportunity several times. In fact, they'd had it on three prior occasions to adopt this rule or this new tort and had declined to do so, said they would in this circumstance, and signaled that they would be very hesitant to expand the law in the future. With that background, the only remaining parts that I address are other alternatives to the tort system, and unless you have any questions, I'll be glad to address any further points you have, and I thank you for...
Mr. Flegel, because we probably will see both of those, could you just give a brief
sure.
explanation? Of
In terms of the alternatives to the tort system, very, very basically, what torts do is to look to the proof that someone is at fault. Somebody did something that a reasonable jury would conclude was the wrong thing. And only upon demonstrating that that wrong thing was done are rights created in the injured person. That's our fault-based tort system. As an alternative to that, legislatively, two fundamental systems have been created as a parallel to the tort system. One is our workers' compensation system, and the other is our No-Fault Automobile Insurance Act. And there the legislature judged that it was more important as a policy matter to assure prompt access to reimbursement of medical bills and lost wages that a non-fault-based system be created to operate automatically without the need to demonstrate fault. Fundamentally, in the auto context, for example, if I rear-ended Chairman Mullery, why he would have to take me to court and prove that I was negligent even to recover his $60 x-ray bill. So the legislature said, we don't want to have lots of these small lawsuits. We'll create a system where medical bills and weight loss get paid from your own insurance irrespective of fault, and then we'll create a system of thresholds or essentially tests. And only if you can satisfy one of these tests can you sue for something beyond your medical bills and wage loss. In the workers' compensation context, a much more comprehensive set of rules exist, but essentially accomplish the same thing. Medical bills, wage loss, and certain other kinds of benefits, all designed to get the injured worker back into the workplace, doing a job and supporting themselves and their family as quickly as possible, are achieved through a non-fault-based system, whether the employer caused the injury, a co-worker, or the worker himself.
Representative Hillstrom, and then Coles, and then Lesh, and maybe you could shorten up the answers just a little bit so we can...
Yes, sir.
We got about 4 minutes.
Mr. Chair, I'll pass.
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Flegel, I've listened to your discussion today, and I guess I've tried to make a list here. Outside of the legislature creating new causes of action, new torts, as I've heard you talk, you haven't really talked about statute of limitations, but clearly that's an area where the legislature can affect the tort system. Talked a little bit about damage caps. We talked a little bit about various evidentiary requirements like the affidavit requirement in professional malpractice cases, and then just recently you talked about immunity. Are there other those are kind of the four things that I identified that the legislature, outside of creating new torts or new causes of action, can have an impact on the tort system that exists. Are there others that ought to be on that list?
Mr. Flegel?
Excuse me, my answer short. None that occur to me, Representative Coles.
Representative Lesh?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Professor Flegel. My question steps a little bit into the No-Fault Act that you mentioned, so it may not necessarily be completely your area, but I'm going to ask anyway because it impacts that separate system as you described it, wherein normally lawsuits, attorneys operate in certain ways and the clients have rights to all ultimate decisions, for example, decisions on settlement, etc. So if I got into a car accident and fault was not determined, but my insurance company did a payout to the other party, it's my understanding that, my insurance company, I'm assuming, would raise my rates or something based on that, despite the fact that I made no admissions and maybe maintained my innocence or whatsoever. So my concern is that, you know, you learn as an attorney that, hang on a second, you have a right to make all ultimate decisions. Under the Minnesota No-Fault Act, can you tell me, is there any kind of remedy for that vis-a-vis your insurance company when you, as, say, a client, under the terms of your policy, really has said nothing? Does that make sense?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Blatch, there is part of what is generally referred to as the Fair Claims Practices Act, which actually does address the no-fault aspect of this. And I think it's 72A 201 Subdivision 15 says that unless you're 50% at fault, they cannot raise your rates if it's just no-fault benefits that are implicated there. There are other, you know, potential remedies that you may have, including just shopping your you're for another carrier if they raise your rates. But they may not legally raise rates in the event that you're less than 50% at fault and only no-fault benefits were paid.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, just to follow up. And so I'm presuming the person who benefits from those higher rates, that being the insurance company, is also the person who unilaterally determines whether or not I'm more than 50% at fault, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesch, the statute doesn't say who gets to make the call there. It does say is found 50%. That would at least to me imply some type of judicial proceeding.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Flegel, for a pretty thorough introduction.
Thank you for inviting
I just got word that Representative Lilly learned so much today that he's called while we were here, and he left for a minute. He called to have his shingle prepared at the printer, and he's putting one out tonight to handle accident cases.
I'm sorry you don't get any continuing legal education credit for the lawyers for this, but thank you kindly for the opportunity to.
Thank you again. We're adjourned.